Dr. King, let's start off with your early years. I understand that you're of Ojibwe ancestry.
Yes, that's right. I'm a member of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, and the Mississaugas are one of several sub-tribes of the Ojibwe peoples. Our original land was where the city of Toronto is now situated. We transferred the land in 1805 through a surrender. The band continued to live in what is now the town of Mississauga until 1847, and then we packed up and moved out to the territory of the Six Nations of the Grand, and we now live on a corner of their territory near Brantford, Ontario.
What was it like for you growing up as a child?
Well, I didn't find it any different because I didn't know any different. I grew up on a reserve. I was born in the Shwekin, which is the village in the middle of the Six Nations Reserve. It had a hospital at the time I was born, no longer does. And I went to elementary school on the reserve. I had an appreciation for education through my father. My father was the first member of our band to go to university in modern times, and he was a teacher. And my mother, who came from Switzerland, also had an appreciation for education. So I had the benefit of two cultures growing up, that of my mother as well as my father.
So when you decided to go to university, what was it that attracted you?
Really, I felt that my father and some of the other teachers on the reserve were real role models, and I went with the intention of becoming a teacher as well. So did my brother, and my brother did follow in our father's footsteps and became a teacher. But I got interested in science in high school and certainly continued in university, and so as university went along, I decided my career ought to be as a scientist.
So when you did go off to university, which campus did you go to?
Well, I went first of all to McMaster, which is close to home. But then when I graduated with my bachelor's, I was a young fellow and I wanted to see the world. And Montreal was a pretty exciting place, and McGill had a very good university. So I ended up at McGill to do my PhD in chemistry.
Now, how is it that you ended up in Alberta?
I graduated from McGill and went for a postdoc, a very exciting thing, to Israel, and there I learned about interdisciplinary work and made a transition to studying biological materials. Then I came back to McGill, not to chemistry this time, but to medicine, and really got into biomedical research involving the study of the lung. And that's been my academic specialty in these last 30 years, essentially. I stayed at McGill for another 8 or more years, I guess around 8 years. And then I had an opportunity to come to Alberta and take up a position that was supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for medical research. And I'm certainly always been grateful for that opportunity. So that got me started in my own independent position as a researcher.
Now, you told me that in relation to your study of the lungs, that you also looked at mucus. Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about that.
Okay, well, mucus forms an essential role in protecting the lungs from external insults like air pollution, cigarette smoke, other things, and it also serves to sweep away bacteria and viruses that people come in contact with. And I found this fascinating because it actually did follow from my PhD studies in the chemistry of gels. Mucus is a gel, and so it was a little bit of a natural transition for a chemist to get into studying mucus this way. So in Israel, I was introduced to an interdisciplinary group. There were chemists like myself, there were biologists, veterinarian, ear, nose, and throat specialist. And we all met every Tuesday morning over cakes and coffee and discussed mucus. It was our mucus group.
With that work, what did that lead into for you?
Well, it led into studies of basic physiology, basic understanding of how the defense system of the lung worked, but it also led to some more practical things in terms of drug development. I got involved in development of drugs to improve the clearance of mucus from the lung, particularly in diseases where that's a problem, such as cystic fibrosis. And I've spent actually quite a lot of my career looking at drugs and physical methods to improve airway mucus clearance.
Now, I understand that you've also spent a lot of time looking at tuberculosis. What is the concern with tuberculosis in our society today?
Well, the fact that tuberculosis is even still with us in Canada is a concern. It's not a concern here in Edmonton or anywhere else in the big cities. It's a concern in the northern isolated communities, almost all of which are Aboriginal communities, First Nations and Inuit. It's a disease of poor social conditions, of poor housing, of poor nutrition, of overcrowding, and so on. And so it really has no place even still existing in Canada. It's not something that most Canadians are even aware of, that it is a problem. But we, in Nunavut in particular, in Inuit areas, the rates are just as bad as they are in many third world countries.
Well, why haven't we been able to tame that?
Part of it is not successfully dealing with the social conditions that facilitate the transmission of tuberculosis. And certainly a lot of it would go away if we were able to improve the housing and the reduced poverty in those northern Aboriginal communities. It's also a case of education and failure to communicate well between health providers and community people. There's a long history of distrust, particularly in the north. People were taken from their homes with tuberculosis in historical times, in the times of people's grandparents now, and many never came back in the 50s and 60s. So there's still a lot of distrust in those northern communities that needs to be overcome.
Is there a concern as well about superbugs, or that the tuberculosis today is more resistant to treatment?
That's certainly an issue, although it's a bigger issue in the tuberculosis of the inner city than it is in the remote communities. But superbugs result from people initiating treatment and not sticking with it. And again, that's a social issue. People falling between the cracks of the healthcare system. And it's something that affects Aboriginal people as well as people who are homeless and poor in general.
Now, you've been in the news recently because of a development that you have made in your research labs, an inhaler. Tell me about that. What has led up to this?
Well, I have been interested in the transmission of airborne diseases. Tuberculosis is certainly one, but influenza virus is certainly another one. So it's partly an Aboriginal project, and in many other ways, and certainly more recently, it's a mainstream worldwide type of project. We've been facing pandemics in Canada and other parts of the world that are transmitted because an infected person can get on a plane somewhere and show up in another country a few hours later and start infecting other people through the contact they make. Well, one of the ways in which that infection can occur is through coughing. The person who is infected coughs, produces droplets, fine aerosol, when they cough, these can hang in the atmosphere for periods of time, even up to hours. And the people who come in contact with that infected air can then themselves get infected. So our idea was to reduce the amount of fine aerosol that people cough out when they're infected or even at other times. So if a person is coming down with the symptoms of the flu, this new drug treatment that we've developed, they would take the drug by an inhaler, and the properties of the mucus would change so that it would become a little bit more cohesive and less likely to form very fine droplets. That instead they would form smaller numbers of larger droplets, which are not nearly as dangerous because they settle out when people cough. They settle onto nearby surfaces. And conventional measures of hygiene, such as hand washing, wiping down surfaces, are actually quite effective at eliminating the risk of transmission. So we want to take out those very fine droplets of aerosol from the equation and convert the fine aerosol into a slightly larger, coarser aerosol, which is less dangerous.
How does that conversion work?
It involves inhaling a substance, and our target compound is a very old drug called dextran, and we use a particular formulation, which is a intermediate molecular weight that causes a certain amount of extra cohesion in the mucus, but not so much that it interferes with the normal function of mucus, which is to protect the lungs. So we deliver this, or we propose to deliver this to humans who are just in the process of coming down with the influenza, to reduce the amount of aerosol they put out and therefore reduce the risk to people around them, such as family members and friends, and also, of course, frontline health workers, say in the emergency department.
So you deliver this through an inhaler, is that it?
Yes. So we'll still have to do some work in developing this inhaler, but we believe it'll be something similar to a conventional asthma inhaler. There would be a dry powder packed inside that would be nebulized or aerosolized. The person would inhale it. It would end up on those airways that are lined with mucus and change the properties of the mucus so that you'd reduce that fine aerosol. So we will work with engineers to really tailor make and refine the inhaler that we need for this project.
The work that you've been doing with the inhaler and then the use of the drug dextran, how does that tie back into your original concern about tuberculosis?
So the project actually started out with an interest in tuberculosis. I was working with a doctor from El Salvador, Gustavo Zayas, where TB is still a problem in his country. And we wanted to have a way of keeping the person who might have TB, who's coughing, but it takes sometimes several weeks to actually diagnose the TB, to find a way to keep them from infecting the people around them and most likely their immediate family while they're being investigated. And the same thing occurs in Canada. The people who get infected by TB are usually close family members, generally little children who are infected by an adult in the home who turns out to have TB. So I see this drug treatment, I hope that it will work for influenza prevention, but it equally could be valuable for tuberculosis prevention. And since that's still such an important issue in our country in Aboriginal people, as well as a third world problem, that this will ultimately bring it back full circle and tie it into Aboriginal health.
When do you expect to actually see this on the market or in use?
The first step in this, or the next step, will be to carry out the first phase of a human clinical trial. That's mostly for safety. A second phase would be to really demonstrate that the dextran, as we've designed it, works to reduce that fine aerosol. And then the third phase would be a much larger multi-center trial where we'd be able to replicate our findings in several other locations. So each of those takes a year or so. And so we're talking about something in the order of 3 to 5 years before we'll finally have the drug on the market.
Who's been supporting your research and development?
Well, so far we've been supported by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research. My engineering colleagues have also been supported by the National Science and Engineering Research Council, and the Alberta Heritage Foundation has supported some of the student awards. We will be able to continue to do this work in those first two phases of the clinical trial with that kind of funding. The third one will require a major increase in funding, and we'll have to work with industry to find the funds that are needed for it.
Now, you're the scientific director of the Institute here for Aboriginal Health. What is it that you're trying to achieve here?
Well, as the scientific director, I'm in the privileged position, I think, of being able to develop research policy that affects Aboriginal health. So we're trying to find better ways to engage Aboriginal people, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples in Canada in health research that affects their lives. Up until this point, until recently at least, research was traditionally carried out by universities and hospitals, and Aboriginal people were the subjects of that research. This just wasn't very successful because there wasn't the engagement in research with Aboriginal communities. It didn't respect their own traditional knowledge and their values, and it didn't involve them in the rollout of the necessary translation of that knowledge that would allow programs and policies to improve health. So we've really, in a way, redesigned how we deliver health research, or how we design health research with Aboriginal peoples, so that we consider Aboriginal communities as partners in the research. And we think that the results will be much better when the peoples involved take an active role in the research that's needed to improve their health.
I would think, too, that things are changing as more young Aboriginal youth take up the sciences and get involved in scientific research and medical research, just like yourself. What do you think?
Certainly that's an essential part of it. And we have seen some significant gains. 10 years ago, there was myself and one other individual who were the only two Aboriginal people who had medical research appointments in Canadian universities. Now we have a few dozen, so that's a big improvement. We've got increased numbers of medical doctors and nurses who, again, interact well with their communities, but perhaps even more important, help to bridge the gap between the communities and their professions in general. We still have a long way to go, though. The numbers of Aboriginal health professionals and researchers are still well below the numbers that one would expect, given that almost 4% of the Canadian population is Aboriginal. We still have a long way to go there. And one of the real limiting factors is the education system and the efficiency of education in Aboriginal communities. We've heard a lot about that, and it is something that needs to be improved. Unfortunately, the majority of Aboriginal teenagers do not graduate from high school. So therefore, they're not going to get into college, university, and professional programs. And so we need to work with educators and others to address those early education issues in high school, junior high school, and elementary.
How do you maintain your ties with your community back in Ontario?
I go back there as often as I can. Sometimes it's only three or four times a year, but electronic communications also help. As an example, I was the guest speaker at the Aboriginal Summer Science Camp that was held on our reserve back in the middle of the summer. And I couldn't get there. It was on a Sunday at noon. And so I Skyped in. And so I conducted a question and answer session with these junior high school students aged 12 to 15 from across the country by Skype.
And being from down east, what's it like being transplanted to the west and dealing with Aboriginal communities here?
It was actually an eye-opener for me, and I think for a lot of us Eastern Aboriginal people who have come here. For one thing, in the East, Aboriginal people are a little bit invisible because we're such a small minority there. And I suppose that's a little bit of an easy way out or a comfort. You're not that noticeable amongst the large group. When I got to Edmonton, it was immediately apparent that there were a lot more Aboriginal people and that almost none of them were in responsible positions in the higher education system. I wasn't the only one to see that. Our Dean of Medicine, who came from Toronto at the same time, saw that too, and he did initiate a program to recruit Aboriginal students into medicine, and that's actually become quite successful. We've had in 15 years about 70 Aboriginal medical doctors graduate from our medical school. So the rest of the country, in fact, have duplicated some of those programs. So we are making progress there.
Thank you very much, Dr. King.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. It's a pleasure.